Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Back in the interrogation room again for minute 89 as the Jones boys go head-to-head on who's going to figure out what. Hal, catch us up on minute 89.
All right, this fantastic interrogation scene continues. Minute 89. In the interrogation room of the Strategic Scientific Reserve in London, Dr. Arnim Zola sits across from Colonel Phillips, his voice calm but weighted. Schmidt believes he walks in the footsteps of the gods. Only the world will satisfy him, explains Zola. Phillips leans forward, incredulous. You do realize that's nuts, don't you? Zola's expression remains steady. What? The sanity of the planet is of no consequence. And why is that? Phillips presses. Because he can do it, Zola replies, his tone sharp. Phillips narrows his eyes. What's his target? Zola tilts his head, puzzled by Phillips' question. His target is everywhere. The scene shifts to a cavernous aircraft hangar where the Red Skull strides beneath a colossal aircraft, its sleek form dwarfing the masked Hydra soldiers standing at attention. He pauses by a small table, holding a bottle of schnapps and a glass, then turns to face the assembly, his voice ringing with conviction. Tomorrow, Hydra will stand master of the world, born to victory on the wings of the Valkyrie. Our enemy's weapons will be powerless against us.
Ooh.
Intense.
Al, your Tommy Lee Jones is just getting better and better.
Oh, stop it some more, Brian.
Yeah, and I'm gonna miss Zola because I think this is his last appearance.
His last dialogue?
Yeah, wow. He did really good with the FAVAC.
Is now the time to bring up my fan script? Is this a good time?
Young Zola, yes. Young Dr. Zola, yeah.
Phillips and Zola doing Waiting for Godot.
Yes. Oh, boy.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
It's fun. I do enjoy a world domination kind of movie. And, you know, it's basically their Bond villains. Where do you go? We have to destroy the whole world. That's the only thing, right? That's going to get anybody's attention. I mean, what's the Normandy invasion compared to this? The other thing I keep thinking about is this is a nice tag that I think Joe or whoever the screenwriter was, or maybe the screenwriter came up with it, maybe Joe came up with it. But if we'll recall, Dr. Erskine, before the big event of turning out the first super soldier, he got out a bottle of schnapps to propose a toast. And here is another thing with the Red Skull planning on on this and saluting with some schnapps and a glass. So maybe that's how it. Maybe that was a standard thing that Erskine did before all of his adventures, and Schmidt came up with that. You know, maybe that's what I should do.
I mean, it's certainly what you would expect, or on the short list of things you would expect a German to toast with.
Yeah.
But that is a nice.
That's a terrific catch, Jim.
Nice,
I love that.
Catch, yeah.
I love that.
But none of the folks are drinking with him, but I guess they're the ones that are going to do the job. So he doesn't have to worry about it. He can have the schnapps.
Well, the masks cover their faces. So, they maybe kinda a straw, hard. A very small straw.
But that's very much on brand for Schmidt, for the Red Skull. That's like, let's celebrate. I'll just get the good
I'll
stuff.
I'll have mine.
I'll have mine. And,
you can watch
the end.
I got to say, Tommy Lee Jones says more by stopping chewing a bite of steak than other actors could say in a page of dialogue.
True.
When he's talking to Schmidt and he gets that little bit of surprise, his target is everywhere. Tommy Lee Jones just stops chewing. And it's like, fantastic. That's great.
That's a great call out, because that, we've talked about the actors eating and all those kinds of things. And we've talked a lot about how actors love to have a good piece of business, something to do. But you know, when that business has your mouth full, it gets, it obviously gets complicated and things. So those timing and stuff like that. So to have that, you know, have that presence of mind, not only to sort of get through some dialogue in an eating scene and just timing everything correctly, but to just use the chewing and the stopping of it so perfectly. Is
it's about all the emotion we ever see that man display.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he's so, so self-contained and so, you know, wound pretty tight. And it's the only slip in his armor is just this pause in his chomping. I think it's great.
Anybody that can laconically toss a grenade across into a bunch of recruits, sure, why not? Colonel Phillips is not the spit take type, so it's more like
you just imagine.
Yeah, what a spit!
What? That just
that's wonderful.
That would so not work. And I don't know about you guys, but you know, I find myself thinking, I don't want to be the guy across from Colonel Phillips who makes him stop chewing his steak.
No, although Zola, he kind of turns the tables here. We talked in the last minute about how, you know, Phillips was in charge of this interrogation. All of a sudden, Zola's kind of turned the tables by telling Phillips something he didn't know and kind of shocks him.
Yeah, we're going to have to go into plausible off-screen action. What happens to Zola now? I mean, we know very much later on into the, you know, the 1970s or 60s and 70s where Zola's paper-clipped in. But what's Phillips' next step with Zola? Does he just let him cool his heels until the end of the war, or does he take him back for further interrogation?
I think he sends him to Alamogordo.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
Something like that. I mean, they've still got a lot to learn about the bluey glow magic energy.
Yeah.
He's the world's best expert.
So they can have his bring in some recovered V4s or whatever they're naming the scepters, and ask him, how do you power this up, and where's the circuit breaker for it?
Go ahead.
I was just wondering what drives Zola now. What's in it for Zola? And you know, I guess we'll give you a nice house in New Mexico.
That's the first thing that occurred to me is if they offered him a nice house in, in Idaho with a picket fence, he'd probably jump at it. I don't know. He's a survivor. He's a weasel. He's a survivor. He'll work for the highest bidder. And I think Uncle Sam's about to become the highest bidder.
Yep. And he's, but I think they'd isolate him. They kind of silo him from everything else. They'll silo him from the rest of Paperclip. They'll silo him from the Manhattan Project, and he'll just have to do his own super science somewhere else. But probably Camp Lehigh, or if not Alamogordo.
Yeah, that's what they're going to do. They're going to set him up with his own nice little lab under very tight supervision, and I think they're going to let him do his thing. That's how he's valuable to them.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to be debriefing for quite a while, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Debriefing and interrogating, but.
And
maybe he'll finally get his own steak.
True. And potatoes and a broccoli. Yes.
You drive a hard bargain, Zola, but okay. Okay. Here's your lab and a steak.
Yes.
The thing I have always wondered with henchmen of any kind, especially, especially Hydra, where do all these Hydra soldiers come from? Are they recruited from the ranks of the German, the German infantry, or is he, where is he pulling them from? They're always faceless. So we don't, they could be robots for all we know.
Yeah. I always imagined that they were like some, faction of the SS that he carved off, but I mean, he could be recruiting from anywhere, but it's not like you had a whole lot of available, military age German men at this point in history. It's not like they weren't all already spoken for. So I think they had to be, I would imagine that getting started, there'd be little cells and there'll be little whispers and somebody would tell a buddy, hey, this other guy's got this thing going. I think you ought to check it out and kind of get absorbed. And then at some point he reaches critical mass where that's what we're seeing in the film is when he's truly striking off and saying, Hydra is bigger than Hitler.
Now, is Hitler doing anything about Hydra? I get the feeling they're so cut off that he doesn't even pay attention to it, other than it being a money drain. So maybe if the guy's off by himself, he doesn't care about it anymore, or.
Well, I mean, Schmidt is clearly running his own game here that Hitler doesn't know anything about. That's been pretty established. And everybody Hitler sends to interrogate him gets disintegrated. So word's not getting back to headquarters.
Yeah, where are all those guys? Good question. I don't know. I think Hitler's got his plate full.
He certainly did, especially by this point into the war, and certainly into the next year. It's
He's already losing Mussolini's support, so
right.
he's got his eyes focused somewhere else than Mordor. So,
I'm just imagining Hitler getting like a monthly PowerPoint report from Schmidt, you know.
Right, exactly.
Here's the latest slides for Der Fuhrer.
Sure. Well, and things like his mental state and his drug use at this point too were certainly starting to manifest. So who knows?
Yeah, and they're
Yeah,
not, I
what
mean,
his shape was.
they're all on Tesseract power now, so they're not costing anything in gas. Excuse me. They're not costing anything in gasoline from Romania. So they're not, you know, it's
Right.
like he's not costing Hitler anything, 'cause he's on his own power plant now.
Except maybe the manpower. You know, I always imagine these foot soldiers as being kind of selected from among the Hitler Youth, or the privates in the German army. If somebody shows a little promise, maybe you say, "Okay, I got this special thing for you. You get to wear black now." You know, you
Exactly.
got to put on the face mask, but you get to wear black. You're gonna look cool.
Yeah, those goggles are awesome.
I think this is probably a special assignment. This is probably the cream of the crop of German youth right here.
I was just wondering if any of them fought in any other campaigns, or if they were always up north. You know, I'm thinking they were probably part of the Norway campaign, and then they just got filtered over to it.
Oh, maybe, yeah. That makes sense. That continuity with Schmidt, yeah. Yeah.
And he's got, I mean, we talked earlier about the workers that he had, that there's always more, they can always get more workers, which I'm assuming the local townspeople of whatever place the factories are located. I just don't know if they were recruiting anybody from there too. It's like, hey, you know something about aircraft fuselages, why don't you come work with us? And,
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. It seems like the workers, the labor, obviously that's going to be just conscripted. We've invaded, we've taken over, and you're going to do this, this, and this. It's not impossible, but you don't automatically envision them, going to townspeople and saying, you can go work in the factory as slave labor, or
Yeah,
come down, fill out an application, and see if you want to check out the Hydra benefits package, and then come work for us.
Hyder benefits.
It's
Talking about henchmen in the Marvel Comics universe reminded me of the great scene in Iron Man 3, where Iron Man's just tearing through a bunch of henchmen, and one of them throws up his gun, puts his gun on the ground, and says, "Honestly, I hate working here. They are so weird." And Iron Man just kind of gives him a wave, like, "All right,
Yeah,
you're
they just
excused.
go.
Move on." And I just love that moment because it's so meta and just so, yeah. You know, if you've just watched 40 guys get taken out by Iron Man, I'm not going to be 41.
Right, whatever they're paying him, it's not enough.
Yeah.
Not enough for that. He's
But
not
I
really a
love that.
believer in the cause. That is a fantastic.
Honestly, I hate working here. I wonder how many
Yeah.
Hydra guys said that after
Yeah.
seeing Captain America come through the door.
Brian, you do a lot of you do you read a lot of comics. Do you have a favorite group of henchmen?
Oh, gosh.
I'm sorry to drop that one on you.
Oh. No, they're all sort of faceless, nameless. I'm trying to think of any that've got any spark or personality at all. Nothing comes to mind, but maybe by the end of the episode, I'll come up with something good.
I'm always
Yeah.
fond of Catwoman's henchmen that wear the little winter caps that have the ears on them in
Yes.
Batman 66. Those are my
Well, I
well.
love Batman 66. I took actually a close watch of that a few years ago. My wife got me the complete set, and I watched every episode of that. And what you notice watching that, I may have mentioned this in a previous episode, but all those actors who played all the henchmen, the Catwoman's henchmen, the Joker's henchmen, they all look like they're about 50, 60 years old. And it's like,
Right.
who would hire these henchmen? And of course, in real life, what it was the producers of the show giving business to their old buddies who they worked with in the 40s and 50s, you know?
Yeah, so Bill Dozier was a great guy for that. It's a retirement program.
He was
program.
Great. Yeah. He was giving work to actors who needed to keep their dues paid and their union membership active. It was fantastic. But the result was you got all these guys who looked like they couldn't punch, their way out of Robin's tights. No, I probably should rephrase that, but we'll let that go as is, Jim.
Blam.
Yeah, oof. But
that'd be a good candidate for some unnecessary censorship. They couldn't beep their way out of Robin's beep.
We'll work on that. I'll fix it in the editing. Yes.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. I had a thought about world building in this minute. There's a real neat line where Schmidt says, "We are born to victory on the wings of the Valkyrie," and that of course calls back to the Nazis' whole fascination with Teutonic imagery and Teutonic mythology, which was real in our world too. But it also kind of harkens back to the Tesseract's origin as an Asgardian relic, the fact that it was hidden in a cask in Norway. Later, we will actually meet a Valkyrie, and this whole the story of Thor, which the movie, backtracking, the Thor movie came out in May 2011. The Captain America movie came out in July 2011. So Thor would have been very much in the minds of people who came to see this movie in 2011. And so the story of Thor is just kind of percolating around in the background of this movie. We never mention Thor. We don't talk about him. We don't have to talk about the Tesseract or anything or where it came from, except that reference to finding it in Norway. But it's just there in the background. And it subtly reminds us of the MCU's past, and it subtly sets up a lot that's coming. It's just a really neat bit of universe building. And so Schmidt's comment about born to victory on the wings of the Valkyrie, I could take almost literally as the wings of the Valkyrie are the Tesseract. It's this Asgardian relic of magic and power. It's almost literally what it is.
And that idea that there's this, as you said, in our world, we say there's real mythology. Is that an oxymoron? But I mean, there's this mythology that exists. And then you have somebody like Hitler and the Nazi party who come along and they co-opt and they do things in the name of that and in the spirit of that. And it's fascinating to think of. And I don't know if there was a missed opportunity or maybe this is something you can tell us we see in comics at some point along the way. But the idea that, as you said, we're quoting Teutonic, all this mythology, we're talking about Valkyries, we're talking about these things, do we ever see sort of as guardians, looking at what the Nazis are doing and saying, what are you doing in our name? What are you, why do you think we would bless this? And, because obviously in reality that was not something that was ever going to happen, but we're co-opting some legend of the past and twisting it and spinning it. But there's, as we know from Thor, there are Asgard is a place and there's people there. And some of these legends are based on people that are still alive in the movie universe. And it's interesting to me to think about that. What would happen if those things sort of came face to face?
Yeah,
I'm thinking of a comic book creator, Walt Simonson, who was both a writer and artist, who did some wonderful, wonderful Thor stories. And I have a tickle in the back of my mind that he addressed that somehow Thor ran into an old Nazi or something like that. The sort of canon of Marvel Comics was that the Norse gods more or less ignored Earth and were cut off from it until Thor, landed on Earth in the early 60s when Marvel Comics started telling his stories.
Right.
Before then, the Norse gods didn't pay much attention to us for, something like 1,000 years or 1,500 years. But I think Walt Simonson might have touched on exactly that point, Hal, where Thor is more or less appalled by what had been done in his name since he'd been gone.
And they didn't really care about Midgard was the name the Asgardians applied to Earth, but I don't think they bothered with it because they had I was reading this now I can't remember in the Wikipedia. There's the humans and the Inhumans was the only things they knew about Earth, and it was like those people, and they never really. The Inhumans didn't work very well in the cinematic universe, but they just didn't bother with them because it was like, well, that's their stuff and they're local and they're primitive people, so we don't really need to get back with them.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although also still talking about Walt Simonson, and he did a storyline where Thor discovered that the gods did derive some power, some energy, sustenance from being worshipped. That's what made them gods. It's a kind of a Tinkerbell situation. You know, if you believe in them, they'll be real.
Or like who mourns for Adonis?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Exactly.
And Thor meets, I think, one of the last Thor worshippers in the world, you know, an old man and that kind of thing. So yes and no. They ignored us. I think you're right about that, but I think they also need us.
Now I'm just trying to imagine an alternate World War II where Hitler was obsessed with Tinkerbell.
clap harder, clap harder.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, who wouldn't be?
What does that lead to? I don't know.
Well, well, I think we've pretty well toasted this particular minute very well. We can put down our schnapps.
I would like to just raise a brief tribute. Howie mentioned Tinkerbell and everything. And the woman who was Tinkerbell's body double, Margaret Carey, just passed away as we're recording this. She died just a short while ago. She was quite old. I don't have that in front of me, but she was in her 90s. Let me see. She was 97, and she passed away in June of 2026. And I know people who knew her. She was a delightful woman. She was the person who the Disney artists filmed to use as a model for the animation of Tinkerbell. And she's just one of the last greats from that era of entertainment and animation. She had a lot of other terrific jobs in show business. And so let's raise a glass of schnapps to Margaret Carey.
Amen.
Here, here. Cheers.
Wow. Well, this has been a fascinating and illuminating conversation for the particular minute. But we always would want to continue the conversation. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this particular episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.